And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us today. Coming up a little later, theater critic J. Wynn Russick is here with her weekly review. We're going to talk about the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime at the Kennedy Center. But we'll start this afternoon with a conversation about some complex issues in the field of bioethics. I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He runs the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Folks in his field think about things like the ethical ramifications of research, how doctors interact with patients, public health policy, and global approaches to things like food distribution and allocation of medicine. Of course, different approaches have different outcomes, and bioethicists think about those outcomes through the prism of the moral dimension of those choices. So today we thought we'd talk a little bit about the public health issue that has dominated the headlines ever since this summer. The Zika virus grabbed the public health spotlight, spread like crazy in certain parts of the world, including an outbreak that has been controlled in the Miami area. One of the approaches to eliminating the virus that scientists are considering involves genetically modifying mosquitoes. So on the surface, it may seem that changing the genetic makeup of some insects shouldn't be cause for alarm. But like so many of the issues that Jeff Kahn and his colleagues consider, it ain't that simple. If you'd like to join part of our conversation, you're welcome to give us a call today, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can drop me a tweet at midday. Tom Hall. Jeff Kahn, welcome to the show. It's good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
So this whole notion of genetic modification, I mean, this is first of all, an increasingly powerful tool. I mean, a lot of people are doing research on this. A lot of people are using it. But there's some sticky wickets associated with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, people may have heard of these new gene editing tools. CRISPR or Cas9 is one of them. They're just much more powerful and precise than the tools that have been used in attempting to do genetic modification of living organisms for a long time. And so there's a sense in the scientific community that we're on the cusp of being able to do much more sophisticated modification, do it much more easily, much more efficiently, and probably in the hands of many more people than had previously been the case. So raising lots of policy and ethics issues in the process.
And less expensive, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, it can be more pervasive and stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about mosquitoes. Who cares if you change the genetic makeup of a bunch of mosquitoes? And first of all, the reason that folks would do that, I guess, is to make... To rid the world of any mosquito that is capable of carrying the Zika virus. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So if you think about mosquito-borne diseases, there are many. Zika is the latest to capture our attention, but malaria, obviously, dengue fever, chikungunya, which is another tropical disease that's getting a little more attention. And different diseases are carried by different mosquitoes. So there are various approaches to try to prevent people from being infected by these vector-borne, as they're called. In this case, the vector is the mosquito diseases. So vaccine is one approach. It's just very hard to do. So it'd be much better if we could vaccinate people so that if they were bitten by an infected mosquito, they would not get sick. The other is to eradicate or at least tamp down the population of the mosquitoes that are carrying these infectious diseases. And so everything from spraying, like pesticides, right, which work, but you have to keep doing it, to these new biological approaches, which would effectively try to modify the mosquito such that it could not pass on the disease, or when it mates, the offspring would be sterile such that the population would crash. That's the theory, at least.
So if the population crashes, does that mean the end game of this is that there'd never be any more mosquitoes on the face of the earth?
Well, first of all, there are many, many species of mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And so the species that carries Zika is called Aedes aegypti. Now, what's interesting about that, it's called that because it came originally from Egypt. And the places we're talking about Zika being prevalent are not Egypt. So it's an invasive species in the places that we're talking about. So that's, I say that only because it's part of the answer is what would happen if it were eradicated from Brazil or eradicated from Florida? Would we be somehow damaging the environment? Well, it's an invasive species already. So it's not as if it was always in the parts of the world where Zika now is becoming prevalent. So it's not as if we're taking something that had always been there and getting rid of it. So that's one answer. The second is if we eradicate aegypti, there are other mosquito species that would probably take its place in the ecological niche that it inhabited. So it's not as if...
Including being a vector for Zika?
Well, probably not. So you get rid of the mosquito.
You would get rid of Zika, though.
You could get rid of the...
Potentially.
Potentially. Yeah. You could at least tamp down the population that carries the Zika virus. You don't have to get rid of all of them. You just have to get rid of enough of them that the whole process doesn't work anymore. So something like 80% reduction, I think, is the goal. The idea is that then other mosquitoes will probably come in and take their place. So if you're thinking about the food chain, so other animals eat mosquitoes. So would that somehow damage bats or other animals that feed on mosquitoes? Well, not necessarily, because other mosquito populations probably would come in and take their place. But it turns out to be much harder than even the way we're talking about it. It's not so simple as to say, well, let's just genetically modify some mosquitoes and release them and all will be good.
So if they were to be able to eradicate 80% of the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, that would virtually eliminate Zika? I mean, what if you're one of the unlucky people that gets stung by one of the 20% of mosquitoes that are left?
There needs to be a certain amount of aegypti in the environment for the virus to circulate and go through the life cycle in a way that would actually still make it infectious. So the idea is, if you could knock down the population from what it was to 20% of what it was, you probably would break the cycle of infection.
That's got to be...
But it's very hard to do.
Carl Sagan would say, billions and billions of mosquitoes, right? That's a lot of mosquitoes.
Well, not so. There's a few ways.
In a lot of different places in the world.
It turns out that aegypti only lives within a 200-meter radius of where it's hatched. So if you were to release genetically modified mosquitoes in an area, they would only cover a 200-meter area. And so if you're talking about trying to protect a city the size of Rio de Janeiro, that's what we were talking about during the Olympics, billions doesn't even cover it. It's probably whatever comes after billions. You have to release them, many, many mosquitoes in many, many places, because the technology that's being discussed, those mosquitoes mate, but then they die. And their offspring die. And so it would have to be continuous release of these genetically modified mosquitoes for this to be effective. So many, many, many billions of mosquitoes released in many different places over time. So very expensive, very time intensive, and we're not even sure that it might work. So it's a technology that people are talking about. There's some early field trials in Brazil, and there's some discussion of introducing some field trials in Florida. But so far, I think the jury's out as to the effectiveness.
So the 200 meters thing is interesting, because this explains why they, in Miami and South Beach, they could go and just spray like a few blocks, an area that comprises a few blocks, and get rid of the mosquitoes. I always wondered, did they give, these mosquitoes maps and GPS, or, those dog sensors, the electric thing, the electric fence for mosquitoes? How did they know not to go into Orlando or, Fort Lauderdale? They don't go.
They don't go very far. So they breed in standing water, I think, as everybody at this point understands. And then they first of all, they don't live very long, and they don't travel very far during their short lifetimes. And they're quite fragile, it turns out. So among the challenges for this genetic modification and release is you have to move them to where it is you want to release them, and they don't all do that. They're not that hardy. So they don't survive the trip that well. And then you have to shake them out of the containers and get them to go. It turns out to be much more complicated than you might think. They're pests to us, but they're quite fragile when they're tried to be used in these public health ways.
Yeah, when we try to enlist them as allies.
Exactly.
So, breeding the concentration, the number of modified mosquitoes would take a long time, it would seem. You can't breed them billions at a time, right? You have to breed them, hundreds at a time?
Well, they're trying to scale up the breeding, but then you need to do it at different in parts of the world where you want to actually release them. You can't ship them over very long distances. So you can't
breed them in Miami and fly them to Rio.
Exactly. Yeah, and so that requires very large capacity sort of laboratory space in the places where you want to breed them and the people who know how to do it. It turned out to be very, very complicated. The other potential approach is to actually insert a gene using these techniques we started to talk about that stay in the population. It's called gene drive, which then all of the subsequent offspring of those early modified mosquitoes would actually have the gene that you want in place. The problem with that is it then drives into the population in a way you can't undo it. So much more efficient, right, and much more effective, but you're unleashing, right, a genetically modified organism into the environment in a way that you really can't undo. There's no sort of self-imposed kill switch.
Give me a scenario in which we would want to undo it. I mean, if it was going to clear up the Zika virus,
well, if we don't,
keep it like that. So
we don't fully understand the implications of releasing a genetically modified organism into the environment. So it's the sort of, what happens to the ecology? And what if we don't get it quite right? And so there's a lot of work going on in the laboratory to make sure that the insertions are what we expect, or the modifications are what we expect, and the effects of those modifications are what we expect, and the mosquitoes behave the way that everybody hopes. So maybe at some point we do have this conversation, as you just did, much more efficient, and would probably work much better and much more cheaply than this continuous creation and release in many different areas. Let's just let the population effectively kill itself, right, by this gene drive approach.
But riskier. I mean, potentially riskier.
Riskier from an ethics perspective, for sure. Riskier from the downstream implications that we don't fully understand. So from a perspective of risk and uncertainty, absolutely riskier. And the question is, when do we think we know enough? That's always going to be the question with these new technologies as they're being introduced in new ways. When do we have enough information? When do we feel confident enough? When are the stakes so sort of high enough for what we're trying to gain that we are willing to accept whatever those risks might be as we think about introduction of things that will be very, very difficult to undo?
Yeah, there's a constant struggle of risk-benefit analysis.
And the future. So this is the new thing that gene editing is offering and creating, is effect on future generations, whether it's future generations of mosquitoes, future generations of plants, or future generations of humans. Once you modify an individual in ways that change can be inherited in their future offspring, it's a very different question than if you were to say, I would like to have more musical aptitude, although you're very musical. We could change you. It's not possible yet, but let's say we could. You could make a decision for yourself, but change you in a way that it wouldn't affect your children and your children's children. So those are very different ethics questions.
It's one thing to release a whole bunch of mosquitoes that might, solve a temporary problem, but it wouldn't last any longer than that mosquito's life. Another thing to have that mosquito and the mosquitoes that derive from them.
Exactly. Yeah, and so the technology that's being proposed now turn out to be mosquitoes that are dependent on tetracycline in their diet. So they're raised in a laboratory.
Tetracycline, the antibiotic.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they add tetracycline to their feed such that keeps them alive. But there's a gene in it that's engineered into them such that when they're in an environment without tetracycline, they mate and die. They just can't survive any longer. So there's a sort of built-in kill switch in the gene, but they then die. And their offspring, they mate and their offspring will die, but that's it. So if you want to have that effect over time, you have to keep making more mosquitoes and keep releasing more mosquitoes.
I understand that the folks that run Google, the company is now called Alphabet, they're hoping to release millions or billions even of these sterilized mosquitoes to stop spread of not only Zika, but stuff like dengue fever. So there are people thinking about doing this in a pretty large scale way. Obviously, the Google folks, they don't think small. What's your take on, what's your guess as to how scaled up this is going to get and how long that's going to take to happen?
Yeah, so they're using a somewhat different technique, but it's not so important, which will create sterile mosquitoes, which when they mate cannot have offspring. But it's the same problem. It's how do you do this at a large enough scale to have a public health effect? Google's got people and money and time, and those three things are probably what you need. Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation have been trying to attack some of these same public health problems as well. Malaria has been a big focus of the Gates Foundation. So I wouldn't underestimate them.
Some reports estimate the Gates Foundation has spent as much as $40 million on this. So are they doing the same thing? Are they going through the mosquito route? Or are they doing medicine?
I think they're looking at all different things, including things. So for malaria, mosquito netting is another big and very successful approach. You just get people to sleep under mosquito nets. They don't get bit as much, and that's a way of controlling infection. Yeah. Very basic kinds of non-technologically sophisticated approaches to public health.
Sometimes you just got to kick it old school,
because
it still works. Great. All right, we're going to take a little break. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We'll have more on issues in bioethics. When we come back, you can join our conversation. Give us a buzz, 410-662 8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet at @MiddayTomHall. I'm glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday. Glad you're hanging with us this afternoon. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will stop by to share her thoughts about the new show at the Kennedy Center in D.C., The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It was a great book, and we'll see if Judy thinks it makes for a good play. And on the way for Midday Friday, our resident foodies John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant and Sasha Wollhandler of Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering will be here to talk fall vegetables and the many, many ways that we can make great things happen with them. We'll also chat a little bit about tailgating and how to make your next trip to the stadium fun and delicious. That's Midday tomorrow at noon. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about some of the hot topics in the wide open field of bioethics as it applies to stuff like medical research and public health. You can join our conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can send me a tweet @MiddayTomHall. So, Jeff, the company that's working on this mosquito stuff is also a company that's evidently genetically modifying salmon, the fish. How's that work? How are they genetically modifying the salmon, and why are they doing that?
Yeah, the same parent company that owns Oxitec, which is the mosquito modification company, owns something called AquaSense, which is a salmon, genetically modified salmon company. They grow twice as fast. They don't grow larger than a regular salmon, but they just get there in half the time. And so they created that technique and those salmon in order to bring salmon, farm-raised salmon, to market more quickly and more cheaply. So it's really a way to just create a more efficient way to raise farm-raised salmon.
Any indication that the farm-raised quickie salmon is any less nutritious or at all dangerous in any way because it has been modified?
The FDA went through a very long and intensive process to determine the answer to that question, and they have ruled the answer is no. It led to a lot of political argument about whether Alaskan salmon should be somehow labeled something different since it was not genetically modified. So when you go to the store or to your fishmonger, how will you know that you're getting one versus the other? And whether the AquaSense salmon should be labeled genetically modified. In the end, that was decided not to be the case, but that Alaskan wild salmon would be so labeled. So you would know whether it was wild, but you wouldn't know whether the farm-raised was genetically modified.
Because that's a big issue. I mean, people have been talking about that now for some years, whether you should label things as genetically modified, corn and stuff like that. What's your take on that? What's the data say about that?
I think that people have strong feelings about the answer to this question, but of course, for time immemorial, humans have been trying to genetically modify the food that we eat. The techniques are just much better now. So hybridized crops. We don't eat maize. We eat a very heavily hybridized product that we call corn that started as maize. But over many, many millennia, by crossbreeding, you get to something that's tastier, higher yield. And now we have techniques to do that much more efficiently. Think about grafting of fruit trees or many other crops. Pretty much everything, frankly, is modified from what it was originally in nature, like the heirloom variety, for lack of a better way to describe it. So now we have techniques that allow us to do that in the laboratory. Whether that makes a difference, I think, is kind of an individual matter. I don't see it as that big a difference, frankly, but some people do. And so if you're thinking about putting a gene from one organism into another, does that matter, or is it just genetic information? Which is shared across all animals.
That's interesting because, you know, if a farmer does it on her farm, that's one thing. If a scientist does it in her lab, that's another thing, although they're essentially doing the same thing.
In a much more efficient way. And so one argument is, well, a gene in a tomato will never make its way into a salmon. right? That can't happen in nature. You can't cross those two things. But you can identify the gene that makes the tomato grow fast and do genetic modification in the laboratory into the salmon such that it now has that gene. But frankly, it's just biochemistry, right? It's A's and C's and T's and G's, the things that make up DNA. And those are no different in a tomato than they are in a salmon, right? The deoxyribonucleic acid, the DNA, the biochemistry is literally the same and indistinguishable if you were to somehow take it out and look at it, you know, as a matter of examining it. You couldn't tell where it came from. And so the question, does it matter whether you can do it in nature or the way that nature works or in a laboratory?
Interesting. We got a question from a caller who's not on the phone anymore, but Brian from Baltimore asked, how did the Aedes aegypti mosquito get from Egypt to Florida if their range is only 200 meters? That's an interesting
question. It is a great question, and the answer is transportation. So boats, stowaways. So standing water, boats, mosquitoes lay their eggs, the boats go, and over time they get moved around. They hitchhike. Yeah. And as you get better and better transit and quicker, shorter times between places, it's just really easy.
They were able to stay alive.
Exactly, and that's how diseases move, too, with people.
And isn't it ironic that, you know, they're coming over here on boats without anybody trying, yet it's difficult to breed them in Florida and put them on a plane and take them to Rio de Janeiro.
Exactly. So here, there's an irony in that. Yeah. And the other thing is to say that the range of many of these pests is moving north as temperatures rise. So Aegypti didn't used to be in Florida and didn't used to be as far north in, you know, in Texas. They start to come north as the temperatures in certain regions of the world get higher, and it becomes a more reasonable climate for those things that otherwise would live only in the tropics.
We'll take that subject up at another time. We're not going to talk about climate change today. I do want to talk about something that is really quite astonishing, and that is that there was a baby born to a Jordanian couple in the spring of this year, who actually has three genetic parents, a three-parent baby. How did that work?
It's a really interesting story. So the best way to describe this is to do a little mind experiment, and I'm going to use a chicken egg as the example. So for some couples, it turns out to be women who pass on a particular kind of disease which are carried by mitochondria. Mitochondria are the things in every cell in our bodies that create energy. And they're in, if you think of a chicken egg, they're in the white part of the egg, the albumin, which is called the cytoplasm in a human cell. They're not in the yellow part, which is we call the nucleus, which is where the things that make us look like who we are, intelligence, we think, all the behavioral traits, the things that make us look related to each other, live in the nuclear DNA. Mitochondrial DNA just do this one thing, which is produce energy. But for some women, they carry a mutation in those mitochondria that cause disease. And so the only way for those women to have genetically related children so that their nuclear DNA is passed on to the next generation without passing on the disease in the mitochondria is to get mitochondrial DNA from a different woman, from a donor. And so what it is think of two eggs. One has the yolk taken out from the woman who's got this mitochondria disease, right, and put it into the cytoplasm of a donor egg. So the donated egg has its yolk taken out, and the yolk from the woman who's got the mitochondrial disease is stuck into the cytoplasm of the donor egg, and then that's fertilized by the partner or the husband's or the donor's sperm, and you get a reconstituted egg embryo, right, with three people's genetic contribution. Now, most of the genetic contribution comes from the nuclear woman, right, and the sperm, but there's a little, and obviously an important little, because it's disease-causing if it's problematic, from this third person. So it's not exactly three parents, but it's certainly genetic contribution from three people, two women and one man. And that had never been done before in the world until this Jordanian couple had this process done. And the way that it happened is an interesting ethics story.
Yeah, and let's get into this thing. But this is kind of, you know, I'm dating myself here, but I'm sure a few of our listeners will remember the movie Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. So this is like Bob, Carol, Ted and Alice, but Ted takes a little break. And so Bob, Carol and Alice have this baby, and it's sort of passing on the good stuff and getting rid of the bad stuff. That sounds like a sort of utopian dream, doesn't it? I mean, wouldn't we all like to do that with all of our children? But you're saying, first of all, it does not affect stuff like looks or, you know, skin color or eye color or, you know, physical characteristics. It just affects this the part of the DNA that that could cause disease.
And it does in a very small proportion of the population. It causes horrible disease. And the children that are born from these women who carry these mutations have either very short lives or a lot of illness during their lives. And it affects the respiratory system, it affects the neurological system, it affects the muscles. It goes throughout the body. And different versions of these mutations have different health effects. So they're quite devastating. And there's no way for these women to have genetically related children without going through a process like this, which could not have been done until these techniques became possible with the precision that now seems available. So this couldn't happen in nature, right? To go back to the conversation we're having before the break, you can't have the contribution from two women and one man unless you go through this laboratory effort to take apart and reconstitute.
And in the case of this woman from Jordan, the mother, she had given birth to two other children, both of whom did have this mitochondrial disease. One of them lasted for 6 years and passed away, and the other died at age 8 months. So this was their third try, and right now the baby's 5 or 6 months old and healthy as can be as far as we can tell.
So far as anybody knows. Now that's the question. That's the first baby in the world to be born as a product of this technique. And the question is, what happens when you put the nuclear DNA from one woman together with the cytoplasm and the mitochondrial DNA from a different woman? Is there some kind of mismatch that can show up at some point in the offspring's life? And we don't know. Now, the other thing to say about this is when you go through this process, the offspring will be genetically modified, right? They're not the same as they would have been had that woman's egg been fertilized by her husband's sperm. And that modification will be passed on, but only in the female offspring, because mitochondria are only passed from mothers to their children. And only the daughters will pass on to their offspring. So if it's in a boy, it will stop with that boy because there's no mitochondria pass when the sperm fertilizes an egg.
And this does bring up all sorts of issues about regulation and what's prohibited in certain countries, what's allowed in certain countries. This is a Jordanian couple who came to New York, who had a procedure done in Mexico, if I'm right about that. So we've got all these different jurisdictions. Why was it such a circuitous route for them to have this procedure done?
So the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in this country, had reviewed this technique, which is called mitochondria replacement techniques, MRT. There are two of them. It's not important what they're called. For safety and efficacy. So the FDA had gone through the typical process that they do for introduction of a new, in this case, it would be reproductive technology, and for the first time determined that they would have jurisdiction for the oversight of the introduction of that new technology because it was more than minimal manipulation of a human egg and embryo. But there were all sorts of ethical issues that were raised by that technique too, and so the FDA doesn't actually deal with ethics issues. It's not within their purview. So they requested from the national academies a review be carried out, which was then the Institute of Medicine, and I chaired that committee. And that committee went through a process over the course of a year of making first an analysis and then recommendations about whether this could go forward. The answer was yes, but with very strict controls. And only, we said, in the first cases, in male offspring, so that there wouldn't be this passage into future generations until we know whether it's safe and what the longer-term health effects would be for the offspring. The FDA was about to act on those recommendations when the Congress, in its budget bill in 2015, inserted a short phrase into the FDA funding part of that bill, which said, you may not review, let alone receive, any proposals that seek to modify human embryos in ways that would create modification for future generations. So the FDA is prohibited in this country from even considering approval of the first clinical trial for this technique in the United States.
And hasn't that sort of been part of legislation even since the Reagan era? I mean, have there been restrictions on the use of human embryos in research?
There have.
Is this sort of a continuation of that or an offshoot?
It feels like it's related, although no one has said, and we're introducing this rider or this prohibition to follow on what's called the Dickey Wicker Amendment, is what you're referring to. And that dates to the first Reagan administration. And it has been put in the budget bill every year since 1982, if I remember correctly, the first introduction. And it prohibits the use of federal dollars on any research that harms or destroys a human embryo. So that means you cannot use taxpayer dollars from the NIH, which is or any of the other parts of our government, but the NIH is the place where federal funding for biomedical research is happening.
Right.
Sorry, the National Institutes of Health, many billions of dollars a year, cannot be used in any research on human embryos, which has really limited the understanding from the scientific community's perspective on how human developmental biology works. Know much, much more about cows and other mammals than we do about humans, because there isn't research done on human embryos because of this prohibition.
It kind of brings to mind the prohibition about research into guns and gun violence and stuff. I mean, just your hands are tied because as a scientist and the scientific community is just simply not allowed to look at it.
Right. And so it can be done with private money. It's a weird feature of American civics. So it's only public money that has this limitation, but that's the engine of basic science in this country and around
sure.
the world, really.
We want to go. Do we still have Ed from Towson on the line? Nope, we don't. We lost Ed from Towson. And I apologize, Ed. You were waiting for a long time, and I couldn't get to you quickly enough. So this is... And interesting, then, this issue of the Jordanian family and this baby, there are some unintended consequences of this ban and prohibition, because now these folks are doing this, but what are the regulations and what's the scientific environment in a country like Mexico or a country like Jordan, for that matter?
So I think exactly the right point to raise. So the FDA was ready to act and introduce first clinical trials with restrictions and controls and oversight and long-term follow-up. And then this ban got implemented. And so the couple, working with a clinic in New York, decided that the best way to do this was to circumvent the ban and go to a place where there were no rules. And so this same clinic that has a location in New York also has a location in Guadalajara, Mexico. And so they did all of the work that American clinicians and American scientists went down to Mexico and performed the things they could not do in the United States on this couple. And then the couple went back to Jordan. So now it becomes very, very hard to do any kind of long-term follow-up on a child. One, because it was performed in a place that doesn't have rules about follow-up. And second, it's a child that now is back in Jordan, and it's hard to imagine how one would follow that child over time.
So the chance for this, for example, these doctors who went to Guadalajara and performed this procedure, they weren't breaking any American law doing this, right?
No. I mean, they'd be breaking American law if they did it in the United States. This is a problem of, you know, our rules only reach as far as our borders. And so they could not do it through the typical process, which is to request from the FDA a license to do this the first time in humans. And then you follow it, and there's a assessment of the safety and the efficacy. And then it goes through an approval with limitations on what it can be used for. But they said, we don't want to wait for that to be allowed in the United States. We'll do it someplace where we don't have to worry about rules. And they said as much. They said, we did it there because there weren't rules.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a flaunting, effectively, of a prohibition. And so one way to drive things underground is to prohibit them. That's the lesson.
Right. Right. There was a clinic in New Jersey in the 90s that was involved in some sort of similar reproductive work. How did that work? We just got a minute or so before we got to take another break. But this is another example of this work was being done, but nobody was able to study it and learn anything from it.
Yeah. So that was a reproductive medicine clinic that for women of advanced maternal age who have a hard time getting pregnant, one theory was that the mitochondria in their eggs were old and tired and not producing energy sufficiently. And so they got the idea that taking donated eggs from younger women and taking out some of the cytoplasm where the mitochondria resided and injecting it into the eggs of the women of advanced maternal age would give them a boost of sorts. But in the process, mixed the mitochondria of the donor woman and the woman who wanted to get pregnant. So it's not a replacement in the sense that this other technique is, but an admixture. And then the egg would then be fertilized by sperm. And those children, some almost two dozen, I think, of those children were born, but not followed. And it was the FDA.
Now, were there legal restrictions against that?
No, that was not restricted, at least at the outset. And the FDA then said, you need to show that this is safe and efficacious or stop doing it. And the clinic effectively ceased and desisted rather than go through the process of applying to the FDA. But those children were not followed carefully, and it wasn't actually...
There was a treasure trove of data that we never picked
up. Exactly, and there was no quantitative measurement of how much mitochondria and how much cytoplasm was picked out of one and injected in another. So there was really an uncontrolled experiment, I think, is the way to say it.
All right. Well, Jeff Kahn, it's always fun to talk to you. We'll have you back soon. And there's so many other issues that you all are grappling with. And this has really been fascinating. Thanks so much for coming by.
My pleasure.
Jeff Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We'll have more on bioethics at our website, wypr.org/Midday. Coming up after a quick break, our weekly theater review with theater critic J. Wynn Russick. But first, a salute to Bob Dylan. He was named today as this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stick around.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changin'.